The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
This is where we ended, defining the demographic transition. Remember the decline in female fertility that's been going on since the end of the 19th century, and you should be familiar with that graph in the book. And we talked about the Darwinian puzzle it represents and how it may be we only have partial solutions about some of the human desires that had evolved before modern times that then, because of changed conditions, might lead to the decline in fertility now, like the evolutionary advantages of timing of pregnancies, timing them so you have more support to raise the kids and so forth, advantages of acquiring wealth, which can take away from reproduction, but in the long run, because you can pass wealth on to children, even grandchildren can have advantages. The text did not mention the effects of crowding, which we mentioned also in the class, because crowding in studies of animals leads to increased stress, increased adrenal secretions, and declining fertility. And human cities certainly lead to overcrowding and can, although there's all kinds of mechanisms we have for reducing the stress of cities, including ignoring everybody and not looking at them and so forth, things that New York City especially is famous for. It's nobody has a totally comprehensive picture of what for the demographic transition. Okay. So let's go on. I want to discuss how you test this idea that men and women differ in how much they invest in parental care on the average just because of societal influences they experience when they're young. This is, of course, a position taken by many feminists, but many others in addition have argued this. So we know from a sociobiological perspective there are probably reasons why that evolved, but how do you test the idea? These ideas aren't worth much if you can't test them. Okay, so now what about this question? How do you test the idea? What kinds of things? How do you look? If it was in the genes, some genetic influence, how can you test for that with humans? It's a way that's become fairly popular, also it's difficult to do. What am I thinking of? Yeah.
Maybe twin studies.
Twin studies, yeah. So how would you do it here? What would you have to find to be able to do that? You'd have to find a number of them, of course, genetically identical twins and fraternal twins, not with different genes, different numbers of shared genes. From 100% to 50% on the average. Okay. And then what would you want to compare? You can just, of course, if they were all raised in the same families, you would pair them and look at, you'd have to have some measure of paternal care and maternal care of young. most people would pay more attention to paternal care because maternal care is usually high anyway, but it's not uniformly high. Some women do care for children less, but most of them do a lot. As soon as I say that, of course, I'm making an assumption that men, on the average, spend less. But then that's what we know, and we want to find out where it's coming from. So if you found these pairs, you would do paired comparisons and find out then if they're more similar if they're genetically identical. And if they're not, would you get more variation if they were genetically different? What else could you do? What do sociobiologists often do in addition to twin studies? What would be one of the things they would do, and this has already been done, you look across many different cultures, and you do find considerable differences across cultures. Maternal care is usually high, but there are cultures where men play a much more active role. Isn't there one culture where the women have their babies and go back to work and the men take care of the babies? I don't know how long that goes on, but it's probably only because in having the baby she lost all that field time. But anyway, because both men and women work very hard in that particular culture. But I've forgotten which culture that is. Can people think of any other way to test it? One would be to look for differences in child-rearing practices, in how much time is spent by different couples in the way they train their children about sex roles. That would be difficult, but it might be possible. Find out. Usually when such things are done, and things like this, and they compare it to the role of genetics, the role of genetics is amazingly more powerful, especially later in life. There are strong early effects of child-rearing practices and other things. But anyway, those are the kinds of answers we're interested in there. Now this one, the Lewontin quote, is well known. It's about the hypotheses that men have a predisposition to seek out multiple sexual partners of high fertility, and they have that tendency more than women. And this is Richard Lewontin's reaction to that. I am a man and I don't go around screwing young girls. I'm human, so I have to be explained. So why wouldn't a sociobiologist be very impressed with that? You should all know this by now. That kind of argument doesn't pass muster as an argument against the science, because they're not concerned so much with individual behavior. They never claim that a genetic tendency is the same as genetic determination. I mean, quite a few men, of course, would say the same thing as Richard Lewontin, but that doesn't take away this overall tendency that's been pulled out of many survey studies of sexual behavior. But what about the second one there? Some men claim loudly that they are monogamous. How does a sociobiologist explain that behavior? I mean, the text doesn't answer these questions. I want you to try to answer it, or I will.
Perhaps the males think it would increase their chances of finding mates. They might be attracted to that.
Because women want a man like that. But if they're already married, they might be saying that because they don't want their woman to be tempted to do the same in revenge or something. There are a lot of, there are advantages to claiming that they're monogamous. There are many interesting stories. I don't know if there's statistics on this, but many of the men who claim the loudest that they're monogamous and this and that, on moral grounds, on often religious grounds, are found not to practice what they preach. So that's another point. In fact, it goes so far in that some of the ones that join the groups that go on militant campaigns against misbehavior actually commit the misbehavior. It's sort of a compensatory device they're engaged in. But that's a matter of human psychology, more a matter for the clinic. So obviously neither of these things are an argument against sociobiology. Now this one, I graded the homework you handed in, but I have to look at those on the web, so we'll talk about that afterwards. Most of you got the major points. Some of you added a few things that I was interested in, went beyond the textbook. Some of you emphasize things that I don't think are part of the answer, so I've commented on that in your when I hand it back, I'll hand those back next time. So some practical issues. This is a particularly interesting chapter. It's the next to the last chapter in the Alcock book on sociobiology. And he starts out with these examples of misuse of scientific findings. And there's, of course, many examples of this. Many of you know about them already. Probably the most famous one is the Nazi Party in Germany claiming that genetics, the science of genetics, supported their views of racism and even genocide, perhaps. What are others? The text talks about the 19th century, so let's put the Nazis first. Nazis and genetics. I'll put a little more on the web than I'm writing here. What's another one? Social Darwinism. Can somebody tell me what social Darwinism was and how it was used?
I think it was used in the 1800s when the rich sort of justified their wealth and power by saying that they were more fit than...
That's right. And the poor were poor because they didn't have the abilities, the rich. It was used to justify dominance and superiority of one group of people in society. So that's called the argument was that actually in social Darwinism is that social groups evolved according to Darwin fitness ideas. Is that the view of sociobiology? It isn't really. Sociobiology, you know, this is something I'll mention again here, I mentioned before. Wilson does talk in his book on sociobiology quite a bit about group evolution. But the way the field has developed since then, almost the total emphasis is put on individual genes and not on group. We do think there are small groups at least probably do evolve if they're better at surviving. The individuals within them survive better. But it's not the major emphasis of the field. But what about sociobiology itself and how it can be misused and sometimes is? I mean, listen to the arguments. Infidelity is natural, therefore understandable, therefore justified. That's the way people think, you see. Subjugation of women is natural, therefore, same thing, justifiable, you see. And that's the way it can be misused. So we'll come back to that, these sociobiology examples later. But this is an important one. I want you to think of different ways to state the same thing in findings of sociobiology. Now, I'll give you one. And just listen to the way I state it. And then think about how I should be stating it. It is natural to being male to want to have power and dominance over others, including women. Isn't that what sociobiology claims? But think about the way I've stated it. It is natural to being male to want to have power and dominance over others, including women. Isn't that what sociobiology says? But that isn't the way a sociobiological hypothesis should be stated. I would state it a little differently. I would say men, more than women, have a tendency on average to strive for positions of power and dominance. So what am I doing by making that kind of change? The first one sounds sort of like men ought to behave in a certain way. You know, they should. That's natural, you see. But sociobiology isn't trying to say people should or shouldn't do anything. It's just saying it's a descriptor of how they behave on the average, indicating that it's an evolved trait. What other things like that? I mean, this is just, I picked one example that feminists have used, and they use others about male-female differences. But there's many others like that that will come, some of them will come up here later. If we just go on, you'll see others. And we can give other examples as we talk about these things. But first, let's deal with this one about medical issues. Examples of medical issues that can be illumined by sociobiological ideas and data. There are things that happen to almost everyone or every woman or every man that seem to happen because of the way people are. In other words, it's something they've inherited that are difficult to explain, and yet they must be adaptive. Now, I'm not going to say that all things that happen and all the way people behave are necessarily adaptive. That can be, we talked earlier in the class about how maladaptive things can arise too, as leftovers of previous behaviors that haven't been totally eliminated. Sometimes they're byproducts of other changes. When they occurred, they were mostly adaptive, but they brought along a few maladaptive things too. But let's get some medical issues. One that the text brings up is morning sickness. This lousy feeling women have, when most women have when they're pregnant, especially early in the pregnancy. It's a sure sign of pregnancy when you get morning sickness, if you didn't know you were pregnant before then. But what is it for? They probably sell medications to eliminate it. Should they? What other things like that happen besides morning sickness? What about fevers? We sell medicines to reduce fever. Should we be reducing it? If you get a fever, do you think that's just a byproduct of fighting infection, or could there be an adaptive function of the fever? Pain, another one. We experience terrible pain. We suffer. Well, what does sociobiology have to say about that? So those are three examples. What about morning sickness? What's it? How is it benefiting the woman in terms of adaptive fitness, genetic fitness? How is that going to increase the likelihood that she's going to be able to perpetuate her genes?
Tell. Women who don't use medicine to control morning sickness have less miscarriages. It's not likely to miscarry.
Yeah, the data indicate that they do miscarry less if they have morning sickness, so it must be doing something. But why the sickness? There are things that cause miscarriages. What are they? Well, infections can cause miscarriages, for example. Anybody else? Well, for one thing, when you're nauseous, you are extremely picky about what you eat. You don't eat anything novel. You eat only things that you're very familiar with and that are very palatable. They don't stop eating, but they're extremely choosy. It's the opposite of neophobia. Remember, in neophobia is when, a rat is very, very hungry. He loses some of his neophobia. Normally, he avoids novel things and eating it. The only time he loses that is when he's extremely hungry, if he's going to starve, and then he will try new things. Okay, and we said that it protects the rat from eating anything poisonous or toxic, okay? Well, think of the woman who's pregnant. There are many substances that a normal person can get away with eating that might be harmful to the fetus. Things that cross the placenta might be harmful to the fetus. So she sticks with the mild things. They're easy, very palatable, and she's very familiar with. She knows her body doesn't react to. So it's playing a role. There are medical publications about fever, similarly about how it can increase fighting of bacteria. Of course, it can get too extreme, and it gets above a certain level, it can cause seizures. You know, they worry about little kids who tend to run high fevers. You know, how many of you ran fevers 105 or more when you were little Fahrenheit? I did. Always made my parents sort of go berserk, because and that's when they start putting the ice packs on you and cooling you down, but in fact I never suffered a seizure. But it can do a febrile fit can cause some brain damage. So yes, it can be maladaptive, but in most cases it's believed that at least milder fevers play a role in fighting disease. Obviously, it's affecting the rate of chemical reactions and so forth. I'm not sure we have the total answer to that. But what about pain? That's a much easier one. Is it so terrible? What happens when something hurts? You're not as functional, right? You can't work very well. You say, I've got such a headache, I can't work. I've got this and that. You know, I can't do my homework tonight because I hurt my wrist. And in sports this afternoon, it's hurting so much I have to go over to medicine, and they give you codeine or something. So what's the purpose of all the pain? The thing is, if we don't have a pain system, we don't avoid injury very well. Mild pain plays a major role, and that just mild pain is just when you feel uncomfortable. You have to really train yourself to sit in one position without moving for a long period of time. Only yogis, trained yogis, can do it. And they've learned to sit in a particular position that's easier on the body and possible for them to totally relax. You know, we keep shifting our position all the time. And what happens if we don't? We do it in even in our sleep. We shift positions in the bed. What happens if we don't? Don't you know?
Bed sores.
Pressure. And why does that occur? Because of reduced circulation in the areas of pressure. Okay? Reduced circulation causes problems. There's more than that. It can cause pressure damage to nerves. So people that aren't turned in the hospital, aren't turned frequently enough, can get pressure damage to nerves. And that means nerves will actually die, peripheral nerve fibers, and have to regenerate before they'll have full function, sensation, and movement. But also just avoiding burns, avoiding too much pressure, and so forth. And the best example there is congenital absence of pain. People with that, because they lack the smallest fibers, the C fibers, in their peripheral nervous system, tend to die young because of too many injuries and stress on their bodies. You really need the pain. Well, these are just all medical issues. So biology makes you think about possible adaptive reasons for things like morning sickness and fever and so forth, which you might not otherwise. The birds and the birds watchers. Bird watchers, meaning people. Why are studies of the behavior of white-fronted bee eaters relevant to human behavior? Because they live in families that exist for a long period of time. They're both social species, humans and these birds, that live in families, closely related individuals living close together, and these families last for a long period of time. That alone would indicate that there would be some adaptive, there must be similar adaptive pressures that makes them like that, and the their behavior within the family should be subject to similar adaptive pressures. What do the bee eaters do that's also similar to what humans do? Remember the Seychelles warblers, the helpers at the nest? Well, this is another species that has helpers at the nest. And who are the helpers? Well, generally the offspring. They can be male or female offspring of the older birds. And the offspring are often found to help their parents feed their younger siblings. And it goes so far as the patriarch might try to prevent a male offspring from nesting. You know, the male offspring goes off, he finds a female, they make these burrows in the side of cliffs, and the male can stay there at the entrance and try to prevent access to the nest. Why? Because if he can make his son get so frustrated, he might just come back home and help with their nest, the parental nest instead, and that actually happens. And the young male, you see, doesn't lose completely because he's still benefiting his genes, but now he's raising individuals that share only 50% of his genes. But they will do it. They'll postpone a year their mating. The female that he had formed a pair bond with often will hang around too, because it's getting too late in the season, she can't find another mate, but she generally won't be a helper at the nest because the explanation from a sociobiology standpoint is that they're not her genetic offspring. So it'll be the young male that will do it. And the female will wait around until that finishes, and then she can establish her own nest. Now, I don't know those studies well enough to know whether the female always hangs around or whether she might go back to her parental nest. That would make sense if she did, because then she would not be losing as much in genetic fitness. Well, you can think of related things that go on with humans. It's very common for older siblings to take care of younger siblings in human families. The period of the stay-at-home period, of course, is much longer for humans, but we do similar things. And it leads into this question about remarriage and stepfamilies, and this is an area of study by sociobiologists that has been somewhat startling to many people, the findings. But what is it that adaptationist thinking predicts about human marriage and stepfamilies? It generally deals with remarriage. Okay, when a pair split up and remarriage occurs and there are children involved, what happens? And the statistics are, when I say what happens, I don't mean what has to happen, because it doesn't have to happen, and it often doesn't. But statistically, there are big differences between the way a stepfather will treat children that he's not genetically related to and children that he is genetically related to. And the same for stepmothers. Okay? The graph in the textbook there is particularly striking. It's on page 202 of your book. It shows the frequency of criminal abuse of children when both parents, in families where both parents are the genetic parents of the child that was abused, and families where both parents, one of them is not the genetic parent. And the difference is whopping. I mean, when both parents are the genetic parents of the child, they will abuse that child less than once in 1,000 among 1,000 kids. Okay, it's very low incidence. And usually when it happens when they're older. But look at the result for abuse by a step-parent, especially for the youngest kids, 0 to 4 years old. It's very high. Okay. It's like 13 per thousand as opposed to less than one. I mean, the difference is incredibly big. So what does that mean? I got married again and I have a stepdaughter. Was that a bad idea? Should we encourage people not to get married again? Should we warn their kids to stay away from the step-parent? You all know the fairy tales of the evil stepmother and all that. They're actually based on reality. They're based on the statistics of child-rearing practices. But remember, these are sociobiology findings, meaning they don't determine individual behavior. They say nothing about morality. They simply describe tendencies. Okay? And I think it is very important for people to realize that they will have a natural tendency to treat their genetic offspring somewhat better, and that they have to be on guard about any possibility. They need to seek help if they have any uncontrollable urge to abuse a child. I don't know how much such counseling ever helps, to tell you the truth, but the statistics are quite clear. Okay. Now, Alcott mentions male-female differences there, a number of them, many of which we've already mentioned in the class. Differences in child rearing, differences that relate to passing on the genes in general. He doesn't deal with other kinds of differences that have been found by scientists. And I just wondered if any of you noticed that. He doesn't mention any of the studies that have come out in brain behavioral studies, where we find differences in brains, correlated differences in behavior. The amount of rough and tumble play, which is related to testosterone levels, for example, he doesn't mention. We could easily deal with sociobiological hypotheses about why that's more important for the male than the female, but in fact females engage in it too, and they also secrete some testosterone. Their adrenal glands secrete it. Okay. And generally, the girls that do that more are secreting more testosterone. Okay, so these are proximate hypotheses, more than hypotheses. They've been verified by studies. Okay, there are other brain differences that, on the statistically, result in greater verbal abilities among females, greater spatial abilities among males, again, statistical differences. Some of the people with the best spatial abilities I've ever met have been females, but statistically they're a little more rare than the males with good spatial abilities. Linear quantitative thinking is more common among males. Women have a different way of solving problems on the average, and often more creative than the males because they don't think in the linear method that are more common among males. These are the kinds of things he doesn't deal with, and you could basically, on this topic, you could go on and on trying to come up with the adaptive reasons why this might have evolved this way. But obviously, in sociobiology, we would have to think of all these things as having evolved because they benefited genetic fitness in some way. That's the main point here. The naturalistic fallacy is the one that I used when I stated the thing about it's natural to being male, to want to have power and dominance over others, etc., including women. I was using the naturalistic fallacy, namely that an evolved tendency is natural and therefore acceptable. That's the fallacy. Okay. This, because you answered a homework about, we don't have to deal with too much. Is it true that all rape is an exercise in power? Who said that? It's quoted in the book, but anybody that went through the period of militant feminism, which isn't so common now, but it used to be very common, and I went through it and I heard these things. I mean, I had a scientist, a fellow, former fellow student of mine at MIT, who confronted me in the hallway one time about brain differences, absolutely denied them. And I was amazed because she wasn't at all interested in the scientific findings. She was, to her, the political point, I mean, to her, finding differences meant justifying the differences in some way. And, you know, the goals were quite admirable. They were fighting for more legal rights on women. And this is a type of thing common among feminists, but other people too. Because people don't they want a way to explain it. And they don't know about monkey behavior and ape behavior that shows that the outlying males that don't get much chance to mate will sometimes force themselves on females. It's actually very common in animals for this to happen. Some of these people claim that it never happens in animals, that only humans do such things. It's really ridiculous because it's very common in studies of animals to find this. And we know it, in fact, does result in better genetic fitness, at least on the average. Okay, well, it's getting late. We've left these appendix questions. I want to you to read on page 215 the statement by Richard Dawkins on Darwinism. I really like it. He says that Darwinism is an explanatory principle for life, but it is not a normative principle for living. He said it was the last thing he would use to determine how he should live. Just to emphasize this point, that we're not talking about why you should do things, how you should behave. We're just talking about how people actually do behave on the average. Okay?